And joining us right now at PMPnetwork.com is one of the pioneers of music, and they're local. The Tombweavers originally, I guess, were an R&B group from Woburn, I believe. We'll find out about that in a minute, though. But they consisted of Margot Sylvia, her husband John, her brother Gilbert, and her cousin Charlotte Davis. So we're going to talk with John Sylvia, who's here with us. And John, I want to welcome you to the program. First of all, is that information correct?
Well, most of it is correct, with the exception of Woburn. Woburn was the location where our manager lived. We originated in the Boston area.
Okay, good. Where?
In the Roxbury, Dorchester area. That's where most of the group was from at that time, back in 1950. Well, 56 was officially when the group did get started.
Yeah, that's where I originated as well. So.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice to know.
First of all, tell us a little bit about how the group started, and were you already a couple with Margot at that time, or is it...
Yes, Margot, yeah. Margot and I were husband and wife, and I had just come out of the Marine Corps, and I was dating Margot prior to going into the Marine Corps, and then when I came out, her and her brother Gilbert were doing duets in the Boston area. They would do whatever talent shows that were around in the Boston area, just doing duets. And then the doo-wop things was really starting to happen, and Margot then decided that she wanted to form a group. She was, without any question, the finder of the group and the originator of the group. So she added her brother naturally, because they had already been singing together. And Charlotte... they went to high school with her, and then I was also added to the group, and that's how the group originated.
Hmm. Now, it's an interesting thing. I was looking at Happy Birthday Baby, and I guess Margot was one of the co-writers of that with her brother, right?
Yeah, no question about it. Margot wrote the words of that song, and her brother Gilbert wrote the music, and there are various stories in reference to that song, but I'd like to... identify by using the phrase, "Let's set the record straight." That song was written by Margot on my behalf, on our behalf. At the time, Margot and I had a mild situation where we went separate ways just for a very short time. And that's, if you listen to the words, that's how the song originated. A few words of the song were changed. Like where it identifies, I was your baby and whatever. We actually had nicknames for each other that were originally used in the song, but when the song got copyrighted, the words got changed to identify her and myself. And that's how it originated.
Wow. And I know that it was released on a small label at one point and then picked up by a larger one. It's been on a few different labels. Tell me a little bit about how long were you guys together, where were you playing, and when all of a sudden did this huge fame come?
Sure. Like you had already identified, it was on a small label by our manager. The original label was Casa Grande, and that was a small record company that our manager did own from Woburn. And we recorded that in Boston at Ace Studio, and it was released, and the record really didn't do anything internationally or across the country. It was, you know, somewhat of just a local thing that was happening. We were going to all of the various record hops back then. That was a very popular and common thing to do. For anyone releasing a new record, we played all of the local record hops in the Boston area and outside of Boston area, especially on Friday and Saturday nights. We would do three or four in one night, just jumping from town to town to try to promote the record. And the record actually took off in an area in Philadelphia. The true story is that there was a disc jockey, and if I'm not mistaken, his name was Norm Light. And he had a very large radio show in the Philadelphia area. And he played Happy, Happy Birthday, Baby. And the story is, without any question, he played the song in error. then after he played the song, he got flooded with phone calls with people of interest inquiring about the song. And that's how the record started to break, was in the Philadelphia area, and then it broke statewide, and then it just started spreading across the country. And at that time, Chess Records out of Chicago approached our manager, and they made an agreement, and Chess purchased the rights, not the rights, but the master of the song, and they released it on their label. Naturally, they were a very large record company with many, many artists, and so they had the money, naturally, and the power to get a worldwide distribution. And that's technically how the song made it. And 1957, August, which I'll never forget, August of 1957, I was just working a regular job, and Margot was not employed at the time. She was home taking care of our children. And we got a call, our manager got a call from the Alan Freed Show, and they were doing a big show at the Brooklyn Paramount. And at the time, that was the premier location for any group wanting to be at. And we were fortunate enough to go there for our very first professional engagement. And Little Richard happened to be the headliner of that show. There were about 12 acts on that show, the Five Keys. You just name the artists back then, they were all on that show. We were there for one entire week, and it was one of the greatest experiences that I'll never forget.
Well, at the time, you and your wife were both in your early 20s. How'd you handle that sudden dose of fame?
Well, we were both level-headed, and we were able to handle it okay. One of the difficulties we had, Margot and I, is naturally we had to leave home, and fortunately, my mother, being the type of mother she was, she took our three children, and she babysat for the three children while we were on the road. Like I say, it was not very easy. It was a quick and fast thing that we had to adjust to, because once we got the notification, we didn't have that much time. And we had to make some quick moves in order to get to the New York show. And once we finished that show, it was just an automatic tour that was set up. We would just toured right across the country with Buddy Holly. You just about name anybody you can think of from that era. And
did you find any problems in any parts of the country because of being an African-American at that time?
Definitely. Definitely. Well, I won't get into the technicalities, but I'm a Cape Verdean, and naturally we have a different appearance than some African Americans, to be honest with you. But we still had the difficulty of touring down south, and we had never faced any segregation, you know, living here in the Boston area in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
We never faced any outright segregation. But as soon as we left the North and we got to what they identified the Mason-Dixon line back then, beyond Virginia, we had two buses. And while we were in the North, in Buffalo or wherever we were playing, we had no problem as far as the hotels we would stay at or anything. But as soon as we got down south, the buses had to become segregated. All of the white artists got on one bus, and the black artists got on another bus. And that was the way it was down south. They were not allowed to even ride the same buses. To think about that today, it just doesn't sound like it's something that really could have happened. But believe me, it did happen. Because I lived it, we lived it, and it's a true story. And when we played the various theaters or whatever locations down south, the white artists naturally could stay at any hotel But there were no black-owned hotels in the South at that time, but there are plenty today.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to stay at what's identified today as bread and breakfast locations. A lot of black families that had very large homes back then, this is where all of your black artists would stay. Not by choice. It was the only way you would have a place to stay. They would rent out their big homes to whatever artists were in the area. They were nice homes, very nice people. And we would stay there overnight, and they would prepare the breakfast for us the next morning and whatever. We would do whatever we had to do. And then we would get on the bus and head to the next town or the next state that we were would be playing that evening. When you're on the road like that, you're jumping from town to town or state to state, and you finish a show tonight and you stay over probably in the town you're in, or you would immediately drive to the next town or the next state, and you would sleep over, get up early in the morning and do what you had to do, and get to the theater for a quick rehearsal and do your show, and it would just continue on and on.
After experiencing this prejudice down south and on racial lines, did you or anybody in the group ever get politically active in terms of civil rights or get in music out that was political at all to try to kind of...
Well, we never got into the political aspect of it, but after the group somewhat came back home, Gilbert, Margot's brother, he definitely became an activist in the Boston area. He was a known activist in the Boston area. And the fact of him experiencing that while we were touring, I feel pretty certain it's what, made him become an activist. But he and I had already experienced that, because when I went into the Marine Corps, I was stationed in North Carolina. That's where I took my boot camp in North Carolina, and then I was stationed in North Carolina as well. And the difficulties back in 54 were the same. So I had somewhat already experienced, that type of segregation to some degree. Not as bad, because, I was taken by appearance to be Spanish because of my orientation. I have the appearance of being Latin, a Latin person. So it was still difficult, but when we toured down south, it was even that much more difficult. And the reason being was because of the black artists that we were with, and also the fact that many of the theaters that we played, and I'm going to tell you a story now that sounds like it's not possible, but believe me, we played theaters and big auditoriums where the white audience were allowed to have the downstairs of this area. They would have, let's say, the downstairs of the main ballroom for dancing, and the black audience could not come down to the main floor. They had to remain in the balcony, and they would only be able to be seated in the balcony. They would not be permitted to do any dancing because there was no dance floor, naturally, in the balcony. That was one of the experiences down south. And another one was, this was the most outlandish one that I can ever remember. And believe me, it's a true story. We played one large theater where the stage was actually the separation of the black audience and the white audience. The stage was dead center, and one side of the stage was the white audience, one side of the stage was the black audience. And we as performers could not face either the left side of the white audience or to the right side, the black audience. We had to sing facing what's identified as the wings as you come in, mm-hmm. come on stage or go off stage. And believe me, that is a true story. And we experienced some difficulties playing down south, where we played like in Alabama or some of the real bad states at the time. Mississippi and Alabama were probably the most notorious, you know, states at the time with segregation. And after leaving the theaters, you know, the buses, we got pelted with stones and pelted with eggs and stuff like that. But yet the people that came to see the show, they would pay a fare to come and see us or whatever. But I guess the people that didn't see the show, and they were definitely diehard prejudiced people, and they just did not like the idea of white artists and black artists being together. And there were, if you had a black member in your group, if your group was white or vice versa, you could not perform down south on stage. If you had a black member in a white group or a white member in a black group, which there were some groups like that back then, they would not be allowed to perform down south on stage at the same time. Either the black member in a white group or vice versa, they would have to remain off stage.
Wow.
So, you know, those are some of the experiences that we faced, and it wasn't very easy for a person of color touring down south at that time. It was very, very difficult. But, you know, we were able to maintain and know the situation. We knew what our boundaries were, and you had to know what your boundaries were. It was at that time. You didn't have a choice. You know, you have a choice naturally today, mm-hmm. but the country at that time was definitely not by choice. It was something that was forced upon you, and naturally you could not object, because if you did, you know, you could be arrested.
Yeah, you certainly wouldn't have a career, that's for sure.
No, definitely not. You could end up getting blackballed, and you just wouldn't want that, you know.
Let me ask you a question. When you were touring with all these folks, and you had this common problem amongst you, did any of these folks that you toured with become lifelong friends? Are you still in touch with some of the people that you originally did?
Oh, yes. You know, we became close friends with a lot of people, like Little Richard. When we were playing, whenever we played the Los Angeles area, Richard would take us to his home back then. We were good friends with Larry Williams, who recorded Boney Maroney and Short Fat Fanny. We made many, many friends. We were good friends with Jimmy Rogers, who did Honeycomb. And we have friends that are still in the business today. Unfortunately, quite a few of them have passed on. But like Pookie Hudson of the Spaniels, he became a very good friend. And we've since our comeback in 2003, we've done many shows with some of the artists that we worked with 40 and 50 years ago, of the ones that naturally are still alive. And it's, right now, we're just rejuvenating our old friendship at a day and age where we, the Tomb Weavers, did not expect to, you know, come back to. Margot, after the group dissolved, she continued to perform as a solo, and she continued to tour the country and do all these shows. But I went into private work, and Charlotte did, and that's the way it continued right up until we met Javi Robbins, who was sponsoring the show at the Plymouth Memorial Hall November 3rd that we're on. And he was the gentleman that without any question got the group back together. He does a show annually every March at Boston Symphony Hall, naturally the most famous theater in Boston, or probably in Massachusetts. And he was doing a show, and Charlotte happened to be there. And some of our friends were on that show, and they were being inducted into Doo-Wop Hall of Fame and things of that nature. And he found out after the show that Charlotte of the Tomb Weavers was in the audience. And he made a connection by calling her, by getting the address from one of the performers. And he asked her about the group getting together to be inducted into next year's inductees. And she got in touch with me, and I naturally was flattered, but I did not want just for Charlotte and I to go on stage and receive our award and walk off, because I wanted it to be something very special to pay tribute to Margot, who was the founder of the group, and she had passed on, and also to her brother, who had passed on. Margot passed on in 91, and her brother in 98. So I was able to find two additional people that I knew very well from owning a nightclub in the area where I live now. And I used to have a Saturday night karaoke, and that's how I met the two people that were added to the group, and they're with us presently. And that's the true story as to how the group got back together. We only went to Symphony Hall just to perform our signature song, Happy, Happy Birthday, Baby, and receive our award. And we got a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Doo-Wop Hall of Fame of America. And that was our only intent. A week after, we received a call from Harvey Robbins, and he identified to me, said, John, we have a show coming up, a couple of shows coming up. Would you be interested with your group in doing the shows? I was caught completely off guard. I didn't know what to say at the time. And so I made contact with Charlotte right away, and she wasn't sure if she wanted to do it, but I had made my decision. I told Charlotte, I'm going for it. I said, we'll never have an opportunity like this again. And so she said, give me a week to think about it. The very same night she called me, she said, okay, count me in. And so naturally I contacted the other two people, and they were naturally for the whole thought, because they had never gone beyond anything other than karaoke on stage.
Mm-hmm. That's a paid gig.
Yeah, so that's the true story as to how we got back together. And since March of 2003, when Javi got us together, we've been touring the country, and it's like a dream come true. And you hear about people getting a second chance, you know, and there are a lot of people that wish they had the opportunity to get a second chance, but we can honestly say that we were fortunate enough to get the second chance. This is our second time around, and believe me, we're enjoying every minute of it.
Johnny, would you have ever thought that you'd be touring in your 70s?
No. If you had told me this 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, because I had retired about 9 years ago, I had retired, and but the only connection I still had with show business was, like I said, I had myself and a partner, we had a very large restaurant nightclub that it was pretty decent, that we had a capacity there of 250 people. And I was bringing in local talent, and I, at one time, even featured Herb Reed and the Platters. So that was basically my connection with show business, and I was doing some small promotions right at the nightclub, and that was basically my only connection with show business. And like I say, it's just unbelievable what has happened to me and Charlotte after all of these years. We were away from the business about 45 or more years, out of it.
I got to give full credit to Harvey Robbins, who came up with the royalty of doo-wop and began honoring people who performed decades before, and many of the young kids have no idea what doo-wop is, and many of them are hearing it for the first time and actually starting to like it, and they hear it on the oldie stations, they
exactly.
Still play it.
You'll be surprised about that, because we just did a show last week. We were at the Rochester, New Hampshire Opera House this past Saturday night with the Skyliners and Kathy Young, and we were very surprised and overwhelmed with meeting some young people in the audience, in their 20s or whatever, you know, wanting our autographs and wanting to hear certain stories about the past. And it's a good feeling when you see a young person or some young people in the audience that are listening to our style of music.
Yeah, you would hate to actually have groupies in their 70s. It wouldn't be an amazing thing.
Well, we have that, too. But it's always enjoyable when we meet people that remember, they remember us. They said, John, we first saw you in Malden, Mass, at the so-and-so church hall, you know, when you were promoting your song, blah, blah, blah. It's amazing. I'll tell you one thing about doo-wop fans. They are very, very knowledgeable, very devoted people, and they know their music. I mean, they can tell you things about 57 and on that some things, you know, just, it's like a flashback, how knowledgeable these people are. But it's really so good to meet some people like that.
When you're on the road, you know, obviously you're also honoring the memory of Gilbert and the memory of Margot. Tell me a little bit about Margot. I know that tomorrow's going to be 15 years since she passed. Tell us a little bit about, you know, her talent and what kept you guys together all that time.
Margot, without any question, was... it's just unfortunate and sad that she died at the age of 54 or 55, because she has so many. She would have had so many good years of, ahead of her, you know, for people to really have known and hear the talent that she had, not only songwriting wise, but as far as the vocal as well. Back at the time when we were touring, back then, anyone that knows the doo-wop scene, there were not that many females back then touring or female groups. One of the few groups, female-wise, was the Chantels. And they had a fantastic lead singer, Arlene Smith. And our lead singer, without any question, was Margot. And that was, like I say, one of the few groups that featured a female vocalist. All of the groups back then were all dominated by male performers.
Mm-hmm.
And believe me, Margot could stand toe-to-toe with any of the females back then. She had such a driving voice. She, in her prime, she didn't even need a microphone. She could just belt it out, and she had such quality in her voice. And you could understand every single word that she would sing. She was a great, great talent, and I just wish that she had lived long enough for people to have really, you know, since the comeback of doo-wop, she would have been so much more appreciated by the comeback of doo-wop since, you know, T.J. Lubinsky doing all of the PBS shows, which unfortunately we missed because of the fact that the group was not back together in time to have been on any of the shows that he has already sponsored.
No.
But I can also identify that we have, since his last show, we have received an email from him identifying that he's hoping to possibly do one more doo-wop show, you know, to be sponsored and played on PBS. And he's already identified to us that if he does do it, that we will definitely be part of it. And that is the goal that we're really looking forward to right now.
That's exciting.
You know, to be able to say this, you know, that is our final goal. Our final goal right now is to hopefully that he is able to do one and we will be able to be part of it. But every show that we do, I always, in a lot of cases, I get very emotional, to be honest with you, like the last show we did at the Rochester Opera House. Margot recorded a song, Come Back to Me. And if you ever listen to this song, there are various female voices in this song, Come Back to Me. Margot does all of the lead singing in that group, and it sounds like there are various people singing this, but all of the voices that you will hear are all the voices of Margot.
I actually heard it. It's on. You can hear it on the web. I mean, it's on the on the web. You know, the other thing I noticed is that she's a beautiful woman. She's a beautiful woman too.
Oh yeah, she was. Yeah. She was a good-looking lady.
Yeah, I noticed that they had a lot of singles that came out with her name on them afterwards. Some of them would say Margot Sylvia and the Tune Weavers. Some would just say Margot Sylvia.
Exactly.
But one of the ones I thought was really interesting was trying to capitalize on the Happy, Happy Birthday thing, and they had the Merry, Merry Christmas Baby.
Right, right.
And then what are you doing New Year's Eve as a follow-up to that?
Right. She, like I say, when she moved to the West Coast, and she was she formed her own publishing company, and she started just doing recordings on her own, and she did all of the writing herself, and all of the promotions, and she was doing very well as far as doing some of the shows across the country with some of the doo-wop groups, and she did one big show with some promoter had put together a show with nothing but female artists of the 50s and 60s, and she toured with them across the country, and like I say, there was no barrier for Margo as far as her voice is concerned, and there were no other females out there that could outdo Margo, because she just had the natural ability and the natural talent, and she would just be herself. She could have been a comedian as well. She just loved being on stage, and she had the best presentation you could think of and stage presence.
Yeah, the only one I could think of that might compare to her, and she came later in life, was Diana Ross.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, who had the same kind of stage presence and, you know.
Margo just enjoyed being on stage. And she had such a relaxed attitude about being on stage. It was a natural thing for her. You would never sense anything different about her. She just took to audiences, and audiences just loved her because she would sometimes joke and clown around with the audience, and it's just a very sad thing that she passed on so young in life.
Absolutely. Yeah. We just want to remind folks that if you want to actually see the band, and you can see John and Charlotte Davis, the remaining members of the band with a couple of new recruits.
Right.
It'll be at the November 3rd at Plymouth Memorial Hall in Plymouth, and
yeah.
Tickets are still available right now to the concert. So.
Well, on that show also, there are, the Del Vikings are on that show.
Norm Wright, we had him on the show.
And Norm Wright is, to take the story a little further back, the very first show, like I identified that we were on at the Brooklyn Paramount, was the first time we met Norman Wright.
Wow.
And back then, Norman Wright had an integrated group. He was, the Del Vikings were one of the very first groups to become integrated. They were all in the Air Force at the time, and they had a white gentleman that sang with the group. And we've reunited our friendship with Norman. We've done now maybe 5 or 6 shows with him since we've been back. And then you have David Somerville, who was the original lead singer of the Diamonds.
Right.
He was on the very first show, Alan Freed Show, at the Brooklyn Paramount.
That was the group they did, Little Darlin'.
Yeah, Little Darlin' and The Stroll.
Yeah.
And then you have Bobby Lewis. He's on the bill. He did Tossin' and Turning.
Right.
And
all these folks have been on our network, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And naturally, us and the Flamingos. I don't know if you, a lot of people are aware of some of the unfortunate things that are going on in music today. There are groups that are copying other groups or...
Yeah, touring under names that because someone else owns the name, you know the people are not related to that group.
Right.
It's terrible.
It's very unfortunate, like certain states. And in fact, the state of Massachusetts is in the process now to try to eliminate any other group coming in trying to use or capitalize on using the same name of a group. Like Herb Reed and the Platters, you have a group out there now. They call themselves the Platters, but there is absolutely no connection.
Yeah, because some New York lawyer bought the name.
Right, exactly.
It's the same as someone saying they're the Tune Weavers and going on and saying Happy Birthday Baby and having you or your or the other, you know, nobody there in the group.
Exactly. It's just like the Flamingos that are going to be on the show with us. There's another Flamingos group, but the Flamingos that are going to be on the show with us, they're the only trademarked Flamingo group that actually own the name. But there are still another group out there that's using the name because at one time a gentleman was a member of the group. So
but the group that's playing with you folks, the Flamingos, how many original members are in that group?
Well, to my knowledge, I think there's one original left in that group, or there's a family connection. I don't know the entire story behind that group, to be honest with you, but I intend to find out once we get to see them.
Well, I think that you know, people should also take note of that. I actually went and saw a group called the Box Tops at one point, and it wasn't the real Box Tops, and they were terrible.
Yeah, well,
terrible.
There's another group out there calling themselves the Diamonds too,
and without David Somerville.
Without David Somerville, or without any member of the original Diamonds, and what happened there? Somehow or other, the name got sold. I don't know how, unfortunately, that happened. But these are four guys, and most of them are musicians, and not one of them have a family connection or any means of connection as far as the Diamonds go.
Yeah, it's because someone owns the name, and they're paying these guys to go on the road as the Diamonds.
Exactly.
And live off someone else's glory and talent.
Exactly. And the thing is, a lot of people that don't know the doo-wop scene, you know, from the originality, a lot of people are being misled and don't know the difference. That's the saddest part about it. But like I say, I know the state of Massachusetts is in the process of passing a bill which would eliminate that. Some other states have already done it, and I'll be glad when it's finally done here so that no other artist can come in capitalizing on someone else's name. It's just unfortunate.
I agree with you. Yeah. Well, I hope everybody goes to the concert, and it was a real thrill for me to actually sit and talk with you and meet you, and I love your music, and I want to continue continue luck for you and good health for you and Charlotte.
And what type of show do you do out of? Are you from the Brockton area?
I do it out of Stoughton, I used to do a show on Brockton Radio and on Boston Radio. And now this is a national show, and anybody around the whole world can hear it.
That's great. It's nice to hear that someone like yourself is still involved with, you know, the music from our era, which has survived for quite some time. When you stop and think about it, it's been 50 years or more that the doo-wop music has been around, and it's still hanging on. And my thanks to you and what other radio personalities are still involved in keeping our music alive, and I really appreciate this conversation with you, Mark.
Well, I appreciate it with you too, Johnny, but I just want to point out that, you know, the music of Beethoven is still around. And,
you're right.
and many other people. And when music is good, and music is catchy, and the music is something you can sing and listen to and enjoy, it lasts a lifetime.
Yeah, especially if you can understand the words and you hear the story behind it. Because most of the songs from back in that era, mostly all of them told a personal story or a group story that was something that you would remember. And again, it's been very nice talking to you, Mark. And
you too.
I hope to meet you someday.
One of these days. It probably won't be on in November, but maybe another time that you're touring, we'll run into each other. Take care of yourself.
Okay, thank you very much. And the best to all of your fans that are out there listening.
And yours as well.
So long now.
Take care.